Welcome to the Tribal Legal Advocacy Series by the National American Indian Court Judges Association. All podcast episodes in this series will feature an exciting discussion with tribal legal experts on important and impactful federal Indian law acts and provisions. Thank you for joining. Now let's get started.
Good afternoon. My name is Nikki Borchardt Campbell, and I'm the Executive Director of the National American Indian Court Judges Association. This afternoon, NIJA is recording the Tribal Court Advocacy Training Series. And today we're going to start with the Indian Child Welfare Act for Tribal Court Advocates. So within this particular podcast, we'll be discussing ICWA, as it's applied in the state context and in state judiciaries and systems, and then perhaps even differentiate between how child welfare is also addressed in tribal courts. So this podcast is for entry-level legal service attorneys. It will give an introductory overview of the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, and it's going to provide a few practical tips. So again, this is for those newer attorneys or for attorneys who are beginning to work with tribal populations. Today with us, we have Catherine Fort, and she's the director of the Indian Law Clinic at Michigan State University College of Law. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Nikki.
Welcome to our inaugural NIJA podcast. And we're so thankful to have you here with us this afternoon to talk a little bit about ICWA and to provide an overview for our listeners and for our legal advocates who are working in our tribal judiciaries.
Great. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. So thank you so much. Let's just go ahead and begin. The first question is, what role does the tribal court or tribal court advocate play in an ICWA proceeding? And so to be clear, this would be an ICWA proceeding in state court.
Right, because I think it's really important for this particular population and people who are listening to differentiate that ICWA actually only applies in state courts, because ICWA is a remedial statute, of course, trying to address the actions of state agencies and state courts, not tribal courts. So there is a lot of things that tribes do related to child welfare, but ICWA doesn't apply in tribal courts. So one of the main areas that tribal courts intersect with the Indian Child Welfare Act is in the transfer of cases from a state court to a tribal court, because, of course, ICWA delineates the jurisdiction over a child and depending on whether the child, where the child lives and where the child is a tribal member. And so tribes and parents have the opportunity to ask the state court that started a case to transfer the case to tribal court.
Thank you. And, you know, that distinction is really important. And especially for our tribal communities, being able to understand, you know, the right to be able to transfer those cases back to tribal courts. So what challenges have you experienced in getting a case transferred to tribal courts? Or what challenges have you seen and heard of in your work with ICWA? And secondly, how have you seen advocates, tribal attorneys, or others overcome some of those obstacles in related to transfer?
So I think that it's important for our, since we're talking to lawyers, we're talking about in this context, 25 U.S.C. 1911 governs all of our jurisdictional proceedings in ICWA. And I think it's important to note that a transfer to tribal court, the language of the law says that a state court, upon request by a tribe or parent, a state court shall transfer the case to tribal court absent good cause to the contrary. The parents also have a veto or an objection. So if a parent objects, if one parent requests or if a tribe requests the case be transferred, but another parent objects, then the case can't be transferred to tribal court. And I think that I'll get into a little bit of the litigation challenges, but I think for tribal advocates, it's really important to remember that, especially when they are perhaps drafting or creating their own child welfare code, that if you are drafting a code that, say, provides less protections for a parent than the state court may provide, there would be reasons why that parent attorney would tell their client, hey, we might want to object to going to tribal court because the burden of proof is different or because the services you may receive are different. And so while tribes should always have their own tribal codes as it reflects their child welfare, that's a consideration. A parent always has that ability to veto that transfer to tribal court. The other challenge is obviously in that little phrase, good cause to the contrary. And what does that mean? And why do state courts get that sort of out for not transferring a case? We know in the legislative history, when you look at the House report, that the purpose of that good cause exception was supposed to be a modified inconvenient forum analysis. So if you really do have, you know, a child in Maine and a tribe in South Dakota, and the child has been in Maine their whole lives, and we're talking about a case and the kid is 10 and living with the relative in Maine, and the tribe motions to try to transfer the case to tribal court, you can see how a trial level state court might agree that that's an inconvenient forum, that that would be too difficult to transfer that case to tribal court. I do think, you know, we're sitting here today talking over Zoom as part of this podcast. I do think that the inconvenient forum analysis is a really interesting one these days. We had I had a case I testified as an expert, not a ICWA qualified expert, but as a jurisdictional expert on ICWA. And the question was whether the case would be transferred from a state court in Nebraska to the tribal court in South Dakota. And the tribe asked me to testify about what is that good cause analysis supposed to be. And the state's attorney who was opposing it tried to get me to say that there would be an inconvenient forum. And I said, you know, I'm testifying at that time from Northern Michigan in a state court in Nebraska about a case where there are people here also in Zoom from South Dakota. I am not sure anymore what our inconvenient analysis looks like for tribes that have the capacity to have Zoom hearings. And that case got transferred to tribal court. So the good cause analysis is really where we see those issues. Some state courts will create additional burdens or barriers to go to tribal court. The old set, I think for new attorneys, it's good to acknowledge that in addition to ICWA, of course, we have federal regulations that passed in 2016 that were adopted in 2016 that govern these cases, as well as your state might have a state ICWA or provisions of child welfare law that govern your state proceedings. I think it's important to note that there are some old guidances that judges still use, such as if you request to transfer at a late stage in the proceedings, which was an old guidance that is no longer in effect. Tribes and parents can request whenever they like. But I do think it's finally an important to note, 1911 governing transfer says that that right of transfer only applies to what we call a foster care proceeding, which can include a guardianship or a step-parent adoption. I'm sorry, not a step-parent adoption, but a third-party custody arrangement. So you can have a foster care proceeding or a termination of parental rights. That one can include a step-parent adoption, essentially, as part of the termination. Those can be transferred. Cases that are post-termination proceedings, so ICWA defines a pre-adoptive placement or an adoptive placement, those are not explicitly listed in 1911 as proceedings that can be transferred. So the big litigation cases we've run into have been attempts by a tribe to transfer an adoption proceeding after the parental rights have been terminated in state court. There's all sorts of really good reasons why tribes choose to do this that we can talk about, but I don't want to talk too long. But there's really good reasons for it, but the law doesn't specifically allow for it. So depending on what state you're in, courts have interpreted that differently. I believe the best case on it, of course, is the In Re MS case in Oklahoma, which basically says the purpose of ICWA, the goal of ICWA, is to allow for that kind of a transfer. And so even though the law doesn't explicitly list post-termination proceedings, we are going to allow this transfer. And finally, state in Michigan, for example, our Michigan Indian Family Preservation Act allows for transfer of any child custody proceeding. So we haven't had to terminate that fight since 2013 when we passed our Michigan Indian Family Preservation Act, or MIFPA.
Thanks, Kate. Since we're talking about transfer, what is the process once a child welfare case is transferred to tribal court from the state court? So can we talk a little bit, you know, take a step back and maybe talk a little bit about process, since, you know, we are talking to advocates and attorneys for children and families?
So there is no set process for transfer, which I think is a really interesting issue and something that I have given multiple presentations on to tribes to try to think about how to do that process. So there's a couple different areas of process. So the first is when a tribe is trying to figure out if they want to ask the case to be transferred. Who makes that request? How do they make that request? What cases are they requesting to transfer and what cases aren't they requesting to transfer is all an internal question that the tribe has to answer, and that we highly recommend the tribal agency, and if the tribal agency has an attorney, a prosecutor, a presenting officer, that they work together to make that decision. Then the question is, in what order do you do things? I personally really like the last I talked to them, where the presenting officer for the tribe goes to tribal court and says, we're going to, you know, motion to transfer this case. Here's all the information we have. We'd like to open this case in tribal court. So they essentially filed the petition in tribal court. The tribal court opens the case, assigns it a number, and then the presenting officer goes to state court and says, we would like to motion this case to transfer to tribal court. You know, here's the case from tribal court. Here's what will happen. I think this is really important because ICWA ultimately leaves the decision on whether to accept transfer or not with the tribal court. So a tribal court has the right to decline jurisdiction of a case. So if you're the agency or the tribal agency, it's always good to make sure you're ducks are in a line, right, at the tribal court, and you have a process on that end before going to state court. I have seen cases where the tribal prosecutor goes to state court, they get the transfer from state court, and then the tribal court says, for whatever reason, that they decline the transfer. This leaves you in a jurisdictional pickle, because when a state court transfers the case to tribal court, the state has no jurisdiction. And again, there's a great case on this out of California. It's In Re MM. Someone tried to appeal a transfer case, and the California Court of Appeals was like, yeah, once we sign the order to transfer at the trial level, there is no jurisdiction anymore at the state anywhere. So there's nothing to appeal, and it has to be in tribal court. And so tribes are always, I have found, really cognizant of making sure that their kids don't fall through cracks in child welfare proceedings, right, to make sure that they know where the kids are. But if you can, it's a tough one, because you can lose jurisdiction if you're not super careful, and then you have to either ask the state to refile or the tribe has to file, and meanwhile you may have a kid in an unsafe situation that no one can act on. So I always think it's important from a process standpoint for the tribe to be all set to go and then go ask for transfer. And then if you're going to have a fight with state court, you have that fight there. You don't have it back internally. The second process that I think a lot of tribes don't have set up super well, or I've noticed that this is an issue, is when a parent requests a transfer. So a parent's attorney can go in at any point into state court and request a transfer to tribal court. There are not a lot of processes for those parent attorneys to contact or get sort of get with the tribe to figure out what I just described, making sure that if they put in their request to the state court and the state court says, yeah, we want to transfer, the tribe may want to decline that transfer and you have the same issue again. So I think having a process for outside parent attorneys to be able to contact the agency, fill out a form, open their own case in tribal court so that the tribe is aware that this request is coming. I think that's a real issue that tribal advocates should be aware of.
Right. Thank you, Kate. What else should attorneys working in tribal courts know about ICWA and know about working with state courts?
There's so much. So generally, tribal advocates are usually going to be representing the tribe or the tribal agency or the tribe's position in state court. So you're going to be there as that representative. And I think I'm going to go into, because this is a short and informal podcast, less formal legal stuff. Like, go read ICWA, obviously. Make sure you know it. But things that I've heard from advocates that often happens to them when they're in state court, a couple things. One is, it is very likely that you will be the expert, even if you have never done an ICWA case. The judge will look to you, the state court judge will look to you as the expert on ICWA, and will often ask for your opinion on things, whether you have the direction from your client or not. And that is always an interesting position to be in. So I highly recommend having as much information as possible, making sure that, so if your client, the tribe, agrees with the state, in this term, parental rights, that you're working closely with the prosecutor or the state agency so that you're on the same page, so that you're keeping track of what's happening. If the tribe disagrees with the state in the case, that's when I say that a case has gone sideways, and you really want to be paying close attention to what the state agency is doing, making sure they're listing, which you should be doing anyway, but in these cases in particular, making sure that they're really stating what active efforts the agency has done to rehabilitate and reunify the Indian family, which is a burden of proof the state has to meet. I'd say along those lines, knowing what your burden is at each hearing. So knowing what the burden of proof is for a foster care placement versus a termination of parental rights, that's different in an ICWA case than in a regular child welfare case. Making sure that it is true that the testimony of a qualified expert witness is part of ICWA, and that testimony has to support the placement or support termination. So it's technically the state's witness, but I also highly recommend the tribal advocate prep that qualified expert witness, especially if, say, that person is an elder in the community you're working in. You want to make sure that elder or whoever that person is a qualified expert witness, is prepared for the questions from both the prosecutor or the state and the cross-examination questions that may come from a parent attorney if it's a contested case. I think it's really good to show up at court with printed out copies of ICWA and printed out copies of the regulations. They're both only about 14 pages long. You can hand them to your, especially if you're in a county where they don't do ICWA very often, you can hand them to all the attorneys, hand one to the judge. I know lots of attorneys who do ICWA cases for tribes do that on the regular. And just really knowing both your client's position and also your own role in that proceeding, and whether you're, which party you are agreeing with, if any, and ensuring that you're in communication with those, with all the parties. So with the parents' attorneys and the state's attorneys and the agency representatives, and then your own tribal, potentially tribal social worker. So if we're talking to people who are, we have tribes that have enough resources, that have attorneys, that are the tribal advocates and attorneys, you're also going to have an agency worker you're going to need to be working with. And then the classic ethics conundrum for every in-house counsel, you know, making sure you know who your client is. Is it the agency? Is it the tribe? Has the tribe given that authority to the agency? What happens if you have a split and you have a tribal council person who wants one placement and the agency wants another? So making sure that's all delineated and clear to the best of your abilities is really important.
All right. Thanks, Kate. And do you have any particular advice for maybe those legal service attorneys who might be representing either parents or children?
Sure. More for parents than for children, mostly just because I work more with parent attorneys. Mm-hmm. But I think that parent attorneys often do not realize the number of rights their clients have under ICWA. ICWA provides, you know, when we look again back at the legislative history and the purpose of ICWA, it was really to address severe due process violations against Indian parents. And so there is a right of notice that's pretty, you know, like you really have to get those notices out. It's not just notice to the tribe, it's notice to the parents. The active efforts provision, and now active efforts is, of course, defined in the federal regulations. There is a lot in that definition that states have to prove up as against a parent for a foster care placement or a termination of parental rights. And finally, I think it's really important that parent attorneys understand the emergency standard in an ICWA case. So when we have a regular child welfare case, right, and the state files a petition and removes a child, every state has an initial hearing, whenever that may be, shelter care, emergency, 24-hour, 40-hour, whatever that hearing is. The standard, if you know your client and that the child is an Indian child under the law, that standard is listed in 1922, 25 U.S.C. 1922, and it's very high. It basically edge or harm to the child shall be returned to the parent at that time. It's not to say, and this is a really important argument that I don't think parent attorneys are making, who don't know the law as well, that the court can continue jurisdiction over the family. If there's an issue, there's nothing that says the court can't continue jurisdiction. But if the thing, that harm that led to the removal, has been ameliorated by the time we get to that first hearing, the child needs to be returned. So sort of the classic example is mom goes out to do whatever mom's going to do. Maybe she is going to go party, but what she did was make sure there was a babysitter back home to take care of the kid, and the babysitter makes a bad choice, right? And the babysitter drinks, or the babysitter has a problem and the police are called and they remove the child from that babysitter. If mom shows up to that first hearing and mom is sober and mom is like, hey, I thought I had done what I was supposed to do for the safety of my kid. It's not my issue. This was the babysitter's. That imminent harm is not there. And so while the agency may still petition to keep jurisdiction over the family, maybe there's other issues, the child should still be returned to the parent at that emergency hearing. And that is an incredibly strong standard. That we don't see applied that often, that early.
Right. All right. Thank you so much for your time, Kate. As we had mentioned earlier, you know, these podcasts are brief overviews of, you know, little bits and pieces of law that we are all running into when we're working with tribal communities. So we don't want to take up too much more of your time. And we thank you so much for being with us.
This podcast was supported by grant number 2015 ALBX K002, awarded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. The Bureau of Justice Assistance is a component of the Department of Justice's Office of Justice Programs, which also includes the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the National Institute of Justice, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, the Office for Victims of Crime, and the SMART Office. Points of view or opinions in this document are those of the author and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice. To access the rest of the Tribal Legal Advocacy Series, including webinars and training modules, please visit tccla-training.org or the NIJA website at naicja.org. All podcasts were recorded by NIJA and our collaborators, edited by Buffalo Nickel Creative. Thank you for listening.